Hello, I'm Andrew Harrison, and that was Gang of Four with new single Change the Locks from their 10th and new album Happy Now, introducing this week's Big Mouth. Sean Patton and I have got a very special guest this week. It's co-founder and sole remaining original feature of the Gang of Four, renowned producer of everyone from Boss Hog and the Jesus Lizard to the Red Hot Chili Peppers and Killing Joke, the man who made guitars angular, it's Andy Gill. Hello, Andy, how you doing?
Hello, yeah, I'm good.
Welcome to Big Mouth. The Gang of Four started out in the 1970s with Britain descending into a steep depression of right-wing politics and looming economic decline. Anything feel familiar at all right now? Feel like you've marched right back into your natural environment?
Yeah. Lots of people keep telling me how relevant we are now. Mm. So, yeah, I'll take that.
Do you get the sort of warm glow of, hate to say I told you so,
no,
about things?
No, I don't get that. I just sort of like, yeah.
We're going to be talking about Happy Now and the return of the Gang of Four in a minute. But first, Sian, we have one of our regulars on the show, do we not?
Yes, we do. David Stubbs is the author of Mars by 1980, the story of electronic music and future days, krautrock and the building of modern Germany. He's a veteran of The Melody Maker, where his Mr. Agreeable character anticipated the free exchange of views that now makes Twitter such fun. And he's a long-suffering Arsenal fan who's written for Goal and When Saturday Comes. Welcome back to Big Mouth, David.
Thank you very much, yeah.
You've been touring Mars by 1980.
Yeah, actually, yeah. I've done various things. I'm off up to the Larne Festival, in fact, to do it this weekend. Doing a sort of like double act thing with Mal out of Cabaret Voltaire.
Fantastic.
Did that earlier on as well.
You've been to Norway too.
Yeah, I went to Norway. Went to Russia, which is quite surreal really as well.
Ooh, what was that?
I was just invited over there and went to St. Petersburg, you know, which is... the magnificent city that I last went there when it was Leningrad, you know. So,
Do they lap up krautrock in Russia?
Not really. They were very respectful, but I honestly don't think anybody understood a word I said. it's been great fun, you know, touring the thing. The trouble is, you know, with something ridiculous, like the story of electronic music, the moment you've finished it, the story is resuming in its own right. So, you know, half the time now I'm just sort of like, you know, talking about wishful additional chapters and things I wish I'd put in and things I wish I'd said and things I wish I'd talked about.
Second edition.
Indeed. Yes, that's just a little suggestion.
We notice you gloating that Britain is still in the EU with a European disco on Facebook.
Yes.
You're posting great Euro electro songs.
Yeah.
Why is electronica so European?
Obviously, I think from the point of view of West Germany in particular, and I think there was such a sort of resurgence of electronic music because with this desire to kind of create new and original forms of rock and popular music that didn't owe anything to the kind of Anglo-American sort of template, and it was an idea to create a sense of new cultural identity after the war. And inevitably, you're going to kind of reach for electronics, you know, which were in the kind of burgeoning phases. I mean, even when it didn't have synths, you know, they used kind of modified regular instruments, like on the very first Tangerine Dream album. Mm-hmm. But funny enough, with Tangerine Dream, when they got their first Mini Moog, it originally belonged to the Rolling Stones. There's a bit of footage on YouTube of Keith Richards trying to mess it up. and then eventually decided it didn't really have a place in Rolling Stones. So Mick Jagger flogged it to someone in Germany, who then flogged it to Edgar Froese out of Tangerine Dream.
Wow.
There you go. Mm-hmm.
What a pop fact. Do you think we need a beeps or a bleeps against Brexit tour?
Yes, I think that could work, definitely. I mean, you know, electronic music is kind of ubiquitous. It could be the kind of final heave, you know, to drive the kind of geriatric psychos, you know, over the edge into oblivion. Yeah.
Music needs to be revolutionary.
Yes.
It really does. You were growing up in Leeds when Andy was forming Gang of Four with John King.
That's right.
Did you go and see them?
I didn't. Oh, yeah, I was just too young. I did. I was actually a member.
You're just making me feel old now.
Actually, other people my age were going out to gigs, but I just couldn't afford. I just had a paper round. I just spent all of my paper round money on records. I just couldn't afford to go out to gigs and stuff. I mean, okay, I went to the Warehouse a little bit later on, but didn't quite overlap. I was, however, the founder, treasurer, and sole member of the Gang of Four, Barrack and Elmick Gang of Four Appreciation Society.
Nice.
It was very hard, oddly enough, you know, to find sort of like-minded spirits, you know, people who, you know, read the Enemy and stuff like that. There were actually incredibly few and far between. It always seemed like there's great armies of these people out there, but wasn't my experience.
Was it just students?
Yeah, probably, yeah. Even when I went to university, I went to Oxford, I couldn't find anybody that, you know, it was hard to find people that were into all of that stuff. It was remarkable, really, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Before we talk more about the Gang of Four, let's have another track from Happy Now. This is Lucky.
Everything.
No, it's not Franz Ferdinand. It's the originators of the trapezoidal guitar and corrosive electronic sound, Gang of Four. Andy, is it flattering to hear your sound returning every 10 years like a scheduled train? Every 10 years, a band turns up and it's like, they sound like the Gang of Four. Whether it's LCD Sound System, The Killers. Does that warm the cockles?
You mentioned Franz Ferdinand, didn't you?
Yes.
Their tour manager, who I know, told me they're slightly irritated by being compared to Gang of Four.
But why?
I don't know. I think some people are, like Tom Morello, say, Andy Gill, massive influence on guitar players, and happy to say it, but I think others would sort of like rather not dwell on that.
Funny, isn't it? Because in the early 2000s, I Love a Man in Uniform would have fitted right in with, young men in very tight shirts.
I mean, people sometimes say to me, there's a bit of Wilco Johnson in what you do in some of your songs, from the past especially, and I was like, yeah, there is, a great admirer.
Yeah. You've mentioned in the past that the Gang of Four sound came as much from a fascination with dub as punk, as in take out elements and let things sit within a gigantic space of its own. Mm. Not many rock bands did that. Where did that come from?
From dub.
Yeah. Well, I mean, where did you come to dub?
I loved, the earlier forms of reggae in the, I guess, 60s, early 70s. Just all those Dave and Ansel Collins and all of those people, and those tracks that were kind of quite different to dub, but a precursor. And you sort of, as you were kind of growing up, so was reggae, and it sort of evolved into this kind of heavier, deeper, slightly more mid-pace groove. Mm. And I just loved that thing when it's the tune's going along, and suddenly the guitar's gone, and maybe it's just the bass on its own.
Yeah.
And I found that so thrilling. Mm. And then the drum's going to come back in, and then there's that moment when they come back in, and it's like, yes, it kind of works a little bit like electronic music, dance music, like you take things out.
Yeah.
You kind of, it's coming, and then it kind of, and all of that stuff, that space, that kind of giddy space, was something that I kind of wanted in Gang of Four.
Yeah. And the band has been a going concern again for over 10 years now, hasn't it? You've kind of reconvened.
Yeah, I mean, it's been, on off.
On off, yeah.
And a lot of it was like whether John King was interested or not, He kind of changed his mind quite a lot. It's been going for a while now.
So what was the thinking behind the Happy Now album? Because it does sound... I mean, one hates to say things like terribly relevant, but it does sound terribly relevant. You've got a song about Ivanka Trump. You've got a song about your music about the kind of increasingly oppressive confusion of the world that surrounds us.
Yeah.
Very much as it was in the days of entertainment. Yeah. What was the thinking behind the record?
I think one of the differences is that I think now that there is this kind of like widespread anxiety. And I'm not just saying, about Brexit or about Donald Trump or, the really obvious things. I think everybody seems to be sort of like identity anxious.
Yeah.
And also happiness anxious. And people are sort of like, am I fulfilled? Am I doing the things that need to fulfill me?
Yeah.
And you can see that in the kind of the way the advertising, especially online, targets those subjects subtly and sometimes very overtly. It's as if we're in the age of anxiety or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
The sort of Brexit stuff and the European sort of far right stuff and Trump just seems to stoke that up.
Yeah, it's an expression rather than a cause.
Yeah.
Yeah. Gang of Four were a proper art school band. I mean, you were signed before you left Leeds University. I remember reading a great feature where you met the other Andy Gill, the great rock writer Andy Gill, who was the two of you have always been confused with each other. And you told about writing songs like History's Not Made by Great Men and writing a dissertation on Manet at the same time.
Yeah.
And they're kind of cross-pollinating each other and sparking off each other.
What a nerd.
Yeah, well, nerd's good, isn't it? I mean, we need some nerds now.
Yeah.
We're in a world of people who proudly... well, when the world is full of people who proudly say, we don't want experts and, books are for idiots. it's more nerdery is required, isn't it, in the world now.
I did a podcast the other day where I was talking about a Manet painting. Mm-hmm. Isn't that weird?
It's your money thereafter, yes. Are we short on art school bands now? I mean, because it was always the wellspring of British pop, wasn't it?
It was.
Quite expensive now. You come out with 50 grand of debt.
I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, you're right. Mm. Yeah. I mean, it was like a great free few years, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And there were no great demands on your time.
Yeah.
Like pesky lectures and stuff.
Yeah.
Great art stuff. School, and there was the Dole was livable on, you know.
Yeah.
Well, art school was basically the Dole for posh kids, wasn't it? Or clever kids. Not even posh kids, actually. Yeah. It was the Dole for kids who could get into art school, really.
But it's definitely closed that one.
Yes. And you mentioned John King's no longer involved, and you have a new vocalist, John Jailer Sterry. Why did John not want to be involved in Gang of Four anymore?
Well, it's like I said, I mean, you know, over the years, he's been very off on, you know, it's like... They ring me up and go, oh, it'd really be great to do it. And you're going for it. And then at other times when we've done a bit of touring or whatever, it's like, oh, I'm going to go and get a job in advertising. You know, but he's just been a bit on and off. And I, you know, sort of need to ask him, really.
Yeah, but it is quite a young band now, isn't it? It's kind of, and it feels like it's got the energy of that. It was Jailer. Where did Jailer come from?
North Kent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, when I was just starting the sort of first proper studio record without John King, which is called What Happens Next. And I was working on that, and I kind of thought, okay, who's going to sing this? And I thought, well, I've got lots of pals that could do this, so it's going to be a collaborations record. And then I was also producing a band in Berlin at the time, and I needed some backing vocals done in London, and Jailer popped in. I can't remember why. Somebody recommended him, and he sang very well on it. And I thought, do you want to have a go at one of these songs? And so he sang it. He sang a couple of tracks on it, and I thought, well, he's really good. So we did a secret gig at the Lexington, and I got everybody to film it, and I kind of pondered it, looked at it, and thought, he's great.
Yeah.
So that's how it happened.
Yeah. And Gang of Four were always famed for their kind of rigorous Marxist analysis, but a lot of people think that, you know, kind of in the contemporary world, the sort of... the kind of join the dots, you know, conspiracy behind everything has possibly done more harm than good. And we now find people sort of disappearing into a web of, you know, the story behind the story behind the story behind the story. Yeah. I remember, you were at school with Adam Curtis from The Power of Nightmares, right?
Yeah. He's a great friend of mine. See him all the time.
Are we living in it? You mentioned the age of anxiety. Are we living in that conspiratorial age now where people think there's always got to be a story behind the story?
Well, if you ask Adam, he definitely is.
So screen goes to black and a voice goes, but they were wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, you know, having sort of looked at the kind of contemporary landscape through the band for, you know, 40 years now, do you feel that your audience is, you know, maybe more open to conspiracy theory than is healthy?
God, that's a really interesting question. I mean, there's something to be written about that, the history of how receptive people are to conspiracy theories. You know, I'm dead anti-conspiracy theories on principle, even if they're right. I think it's important to just like, evaluate things on the information you've got. And of course, you might not have all of the information. You probably don't. But you also need to kind of take into account probability and the likelihood of such and such actually happening at a certain time.
You should speak to Curtis. He can make the film. You can make the album.
Yeah.
Gazam Kunstwerk.
We'd be fighting all the time, and he'd be the other end of the argument, which actually could be quite good.
That's good. Just before we move on, not a lot of people know this, but your wife, the journalist Catherine May, is the co-founder of the Women's Equality Party.
She is.
Do you help? Do you, like, in a subservient mailed role?
Are you saying, do I load the washing up machine?
No, I'm saying, do you make the tea for the meetings? Do you help as a good man supporting the Women's Equality Party would be?
Yeah, keep out of the way, yeah.
It's a fascinating project, though, because, I mean...
It is a fascinating project.
It's finally Sean, you're a woman. What do you think about the Women's Equality Party? Two blokes talking about the Women's Equality
Party. I'm very interested. I'm just letting you speak.
On behalf of all women, yeah.
Well, I know. I mean, that's always, you know, it's like if you start talking about it, it's like, are you sure you're qualified? You know, but that's not the point of it. You know, it is supposed to be, I mean, they want as many men as possible to join, you know, and not be scared off. That is the kind of point.
Excellent.
It's for everybody.
There we go. Vote Women's Equality Party in the forthcoming European elections that we're going to have, yeah, whether we want them or not.
Absolutely. Sean. Later in the show, we'll be looking at Being Frank, the Chris Seavey story. It's a startling new documentary telling you a fair bit more about the life of Frank Sidebottom than you thought there was to know. And we've got two albums from rave veterans, the Chemical Brothers, and young person's favourite, Billie Eilish. Don't forget, you can get every edition of Big Mouth a day early if you support our valuable work on the crowdfunding platform Patreon. Sign up for the price of a pint each month to cover our studio bills, and we'll send you the show as soon as it's ready. You will also get the extra bit too, exclusive to our Patreon backers. This week, Andy and David will be naming yet more of the best and worst gigs they've ever been to. Search Patreon Big Mouth to find out more. All we're saying is buy us a pint.
I'm ready.
Oh, it's my proper telly show.
When he came back, he had his own show, and you go, this is fucking brilliant. And it was only going out within Manchester Cable TV.
He was like, I'll do it for free. I'll do it for nothing. He just wanted complete creative control, and somehow he managed to get that.
It really is.
Thank you.
Right, now, you've got a new song out, haven't you?
Yes, I
did
have.
You write that?
I did, yes.
What colour pen did you use?
I don't remember.
The guests were purely a stooge for Frank to bounce off.
David Soul was, I think, very confused and wanting to leave.
Do you have to sign loads of autographs?
Oh, no, only on cheques and...
All right, do you have to copy it off the label in your vest, or do you know your name off by heart?
I know it mostly by heart.
If you created a list of the 100 most non-asked questions on the chat show, Frank would have covered them.
You ever been on an airplane?
Once or twice.
What's that like? Really, do you have to hold your nose?
These are really good questions, you know. Nobody's ever asked me questions like this before.
That was good, wasn't it? Oh, yes, very entertaining. Well, nice of you to say so, little Frank.
Right, let's start with Being Frank, the Chris Seavey story. It is the tale of Frank Sidebottom, or rather, the man who created the monster. Exhaustive research, which entailed going through hours of C60s, numerous fanzines, Betamax tapes, scribbled notes and mouldy cardboard, filmmaker Steve Sullivan has pieced together the definitive documentary on the papier-mâché-headed legend. His aim is to reveal the real person behind the comedian, pop star and all-round mis-entertainer Frank Sidebottom. Before we discuss it any further, let's listen to Chris Seavey as himself with Cello Man.
There's a chair over there that I usually share with you.
Chris Seavey is now on a par with Fire Festival in having not one but two films made about him, the other being the rather odd Frank, which starred Michael Fassbender from 2014. This shows an artistic life very much before the internet. Fanzines, cassette demos, bands playing shitty pub gigs, ringing people on actual phones to discuss the Beatles at midnight, etc., etc. David, does this start as a document of the late 1970s before going into the
story? Yeah, I mean, what you just said, that's definitely part of an appeal for me. I mean, you know, I mean, the internet was something that really hit. It wasn't really something that hit in the 90s. The first few years of the internet were just dial-up, wasn't it? You know, it was almost like a kind of bolt-on, really, of the culture. It's only really in about the early 2000s that it really takes over our lives, the extent that it's done. And yeah, and that was well into my 30s by then. And I can't even understand how I used to live in that world. And it is a kind of, you know, sharp reminder of, like, the stuff of that world, you know, cassettes and VCRs. And just the sort of the sheer visual sort of all texture of everything. Absolutely. I mean, that was something that kind of really, well, but many other things kind of grabbed me about, you know, the first part of the film. With old Frank Sidebottom, I must admit, you know, he was with the Freshies earlier on.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a point where somebody says, oh, it was a kind of a reaction against all that kind of gloomy overcoat wearing, oh, I'm so cool, Joy Division, you know, type sort of person. Well, that was me. I was that person. I was cool and gloomy and overcoated. And I think I must admit that at the time I had a bit of an aversion to groups like that had IES on the name, you know, the Dickies, the Incredible Shrinking Dickies. I just thought that was a kind of dodgy offshoot of punk, post punk was this kind of quirky, coloured rimmed spectacles,
stop having fun.
Colin Hunt, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, and I thought, no, this is it. And Colin I thought that kind of humour and music just didn't work. It wasn't didn't really kind of enhance the music, and it wasn't particularly funny or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I kind of stuck with that kind of opinion without really investigating Frank Sidebottom. And then eventually saw him at Reading in the 90s.
Yes.
Not the Reading festival I have there,
not
the 92 one.
Yeah.
He came back later. And I kind of got it then. I suppose with this film, it was the first time I kind of really, really revisited his work in full. And he's such a clearly kind of a compulsive character. I mean, is there the sort of sadness about it, or the fact that part of him just wanted to be a kind of badly drawn boy type figure, just sort of creating these sort of neo-Beatles-y type songs. But he ends up being kind of consumed, consumed by this kind of Frank, the papier-mâché head. And then he's all little offshoots, and little Frank.
Yes.
It's absolutely extraordinary. One thing that I did think is, there's not many things that I would call art that come up from music, but I think he has all the sort of the habits, the compulsiveness of an artist, a true artist. And I think also the sheer gratuitousness of what he does. For me, it qualifies as art. Other people are kind of getting, it's quite right that he had his own exhibition. Other people get exhibitions, whatever he might have done, if it weren't for the humour. I think that because he's actually very funny at the same time, he's less likely to be considered as art, which I kind of think is.
Yeah, there is an element of Grayson
ironic.
Perry in him, isn't there?
Yeah.
But it's brightly coloured and it's populist,
but
it's funny, so it can't be art. And actually, it was.
Yeah, Grayson Perry's run with that, though. He's done rather well. Where Chris, this is a tale of someone who is desperate to make something, to have recognition.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that in a negative way. Andy, did this reflect any of your experiences of trying to make it in New Wave Britain?
No. I'm sort of with him, what he just said, about any like the Dickies thing, or stuff that's supposed to be a bit lighthearted or, as you say, coloured rim spectacles and stuff. Yeah, I like to be gloomy and serious.
Did you remember the Freshies? Were they on the circuit?
Don't remember at all.
Oh, really?
No. And when I became aware of the character, of the Frank Sidebottom character, I kind of looked for a minute. I thought, no, it's not for me. And so I didn't really, I was very aware of the character. Made me think of, was it The Residents that all walked
Yeah,
around?
Yeah.
Made me think of The Residents for a second. Mm. And having said that, I think the film, this documentary, is quite brilliant. I think it's, the way it's got all this kind of stuff from VCRs and the look of it.
Yeah.
And the way it's put together, it's really clever.
At a pure archival level, it's amazing, isn't it?
And
you're right about the grain of film and the grain of the illustration, but also the kind of absolute prolific nature of Frank and Chris. You just to me, it's like, here's a guy who is not consumed so much by Frank Sidebottom. It's like, he can't stop creating. He's utterly incontinent.
The way it's edited and put together, it really stresses that, all the stuff. I mean, it's like Kurt Schwitters or something like that.
I mean, to me, it's like, this is the kind of outsider artist that you would see building a mad stucco palace in Los Angeles in the middle of nowhere. And there's a great
out
bit
of
where,
biscuit tins.
He starts playing with the Sunday League side and starts hand drawing programs in unimaginable detail. Loads of jokes, and the artwork is always of a very high standard, instantly recognisable Frank Sidebottom style, isn't it? And these are not to be seen by anybody at all. This is just for him and maybe one or two of his mates. I just find it remarkable.
Yeah, as you say, slightly creatively incontinent. Yeah.
I mean, there's a bit that, where he's doing a demo, and obviously this is the stuff that's been found in the cellar. He's doing a demo, and his dad comes in and asks him when he's going to clean the car, and is it any time soon? That sort of thing. And he keeps it in. I mean, he didn't rewind and then go out. As in every sort of single second of his life, he needed to be documented.
Yeah. But it's quite telling, that little point, because he says to him something like, "You'll do it when it's convenient for me, not when it's convenient for you." And he's just saying, "Oh, lovely dad, then, eh?" That's caused no further problems in life, because he must be about 18 or 19 at that point, and his dad's still talking to him like that, like he's about 12.
Yeah. Andrew, do you remember the Frank Sidebottom mainstream years? So that is Reading 92, introducing Bros at Wembley, which I thought was amazing.
That was fantastic.
Well, actually, Sean, you'll be unsurprised to learn I was into Frank Sidebottom well before the mainstream years. I was into him when he was Southern Death Frank Sidebottom.
Yeah. The Flexidisc.
The Flexidisc years, when he sang Queen. I really loved Frank Sidebottom, and I loved this film enormously. I did find that when he got big, it did seem that he started to appeal to a bit of a beer monster audience who just wanted to get, you know, go and sing We Are the Champions and climb all over each other. There's a bit where in some of the footage where somebody climbs on the shoulder, somebody in the audience climbs on the shoulders of their mates and punches little Frank. Ooh. And I thought, that's not side bottom-esque. That's not. He sort of brought in, you know, it's a bit like, you know, when bands go stadium and suddenly that, you know, in the days when you were more likely to get beaten up by a bloke in a U2 t-shirt than somebody in a Cult t-shirt.
I mean, I sort of detected something that was a little bit out of control and possibly slightly nasty.
Yeah.
You know, that he'd. There's a bit where he puts that older woman's head in the water and it kind of pushes it in.
Yes, and I thought, the TV show.
He's not gentle, you know.
It's a very funny, weird sketch where he's making her do Duck Apple, except it's for Betamax tapes.
Yeah.
But you're right, he does slightly shove her head in the water a bit too hard.
Yeah.
And there are other bits around that moment where he's doing an interview for Manchester TV or something, supposedly in the centre of Manchester, where there's a fountain. And he jumps in the fountain and he's pointing at the fountain. You think, mate, you're getting a bit out of control here.
But there's a fascinating bit, and I think one of the strengths of this is they've got the family talking and has the wife talking about what... It wasn't a first date because they hadn't yet kissed, but they're walking along the canal and they're friends. And she says, "We're walking along, we're having a chat." And he just pushes me in the canal for no reason whatsoever.
Yeah,
almost a sort of Tourette's of him that suddenly she's in the canal. She said, "You know what it's like? You're just, it's not just water in there, you're just covered in really weird stuff." She tries to push him in, that doesn't work. So then they have a kiss, and it's just, this is actually, he's a really odd man.
And then she said, that was when I realised I loved him.
Yes, I know this. Yeah.
This is where I've been going wrong all these years, not showing girls in the canal. That's clearly what works, that's what women want.
Yeah, so there's obviously this side to him, and it's prefaced, the beginning of the film has one of his friends talking about great performances are the ones that achieve madness, and he achieved madness. And you do, and what I think is so good about the filmmaking is you see more than Reading 92, Frank Sidebottom. You see a man struggling with an alter ego who then has another alter ego, which is little Frank. This is a war. This is a very difficult personality and how they fit in with the world.
What's the classic movie where the man is possessed by his ventriloquist dummy? What
is it's the Dead of Night, I think.
Dead of Night.
Very much a little Frank thing.
Is it Dead of Night, the one with all the...
That's right, with the various stories, and that's one of them. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's a great film.
So there's you're absolutely right, there's a psychodrama going on.
Yeah. And we didn't get it with John Shuttleworth.
I was just going to say John Shuttleworth, oddly enough, because you can contrast with John Shuttleworth, who's got this, I think, very, very funny creation, but it's very kind of controlled and it's very sort of, you know, that like Graham Fellows, you know, you sense that he's a much more sort of balanced individual, and he puts out this kind of, you know, very, very professionally sort of, you know, edited and conceived and written product or whatever. Whereas Frank Sidebottom is also, you know, in that kind of like comic realm, but there's all of this kind of madness, this incontinence, this lack of control, all this roiling, seething sort of resentment, even at his own creation, this melding of him and his own creation or whatever.
It is
the kind of the madness, the recklessness of the artist that then lends him to be kind of alcoholic. It means he's an utter spendthrift or whatever. It brings about a kind of ruin in his life, really.
Yeah. And there's some very poignant bits where we actually do see him taking the papier-mâché hat off.
Yeah.
Look on his face, and he's exhausted, and he's got that thing on his nose that makes you talk like Frank.
The swimming nose clip.
He looks exhausted,
And I didn't remember that shot as well, where the camera tracks inside the helmet.
Oh, isn't that amazing?
It really is.
You see what it's like to be Frank Sidebottom.
Yeah, and there's a sort of an amazement, but also a horror to it. And it's like this thing is a parasite on his body.
Yeah.
But I mean, during that section, you see him take the head off a few times. It's almost like kind of Mondo's sequence where he has the same expression each time. He takes the head off and he looks exhausted. He looks broken in a way. And that's, you know, that is the Tears of the Clown idea, which this film does have, which we could see as a cliche. Yeah.
I've got to say, I think this is an absolutely incredible film. I recommend it to anybody to see it just for the. And it made me feel a little bit guilty that perhaps I'd sort of not paid enough attention to Frank, because there were things I recognised, but there were other things he did I had no idea he'd been involved in. It was so prolific beyond words, and I think Dave is right. You know, basically an artist who just happens to put a foot in the wrong genre and is not treated the way that he should have been treated.
I think it's really, you're right, and it's really sensitively made. It's very sad towards the end, and I also hadn't known that his son Harry, who's in the film, had died after he had been recorded for the film. And there's a tragedy to it then, and then another layer of tragedy, and it's really good, and I hope everyone should go and see it.
Yeah, it's a great film.
I absolutely agree. It's out now. Anyway, it's very hard to improve upon Frank Sidebottom for music, but we're going to give it a go. We always ask our guests to bring in a tune each, an editor's recommendation, if you will. David Stubbs, what have you got for us?
Yeah, it's Young Gods. It's a track from Data Mirage Tangram, their new album. And it is...
It's called All My Skin Standing, David, because
you can't find it on your phone. That's right. I just wanted to get it right, because I always get... I'm just rubbish with titles. But yes, it's called... Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But, I mean, it's interesting, because what struck me, you know, when I listened to the new Gang of Four album, is that this is a kind of a really sort of fresh and contemporary iteration, you know, of the group. It's not just simply kind of retreading the old sort of Gang of Four tropes or whatever of the late 70s, early 80s. Young Gods, you know, they were first known in a combination of, like, drums, you know, sampler and vocals, whatever, and they made this kind of really kind of incredible sort of industrial, sort of repetitive sound, whatever, based on using samples of old rock music, whatever. And that was their thing, But for this new album, which they kind of birthed in a series of gigs in this kind of jazz festival in Switzerland, it's got a completely different feel. Franz Treitel was always a guitarist, and he's playing guitar on this album. It's got much more of a kind of atmospheric bluesy feel. It's also exacerbated by he's partly of Brazilian descent, is France, and going on these kind of trips to the Amazon and doing field recordings there and things like that. And that kind of feeds into this particular track which is referenced.
Well, this is 11 minutes of mantra-filled electronic oompah, and it's probably time they stop calling themselves the Young Gods, isn't it?
Yes.
Like the Pet Shop Men. We can only fit a bit of it in, but there's 11 minutes of this. Check it out on your favourite streaming service. This is Young Gods and All My Skin Standing. Staying with the Mantric and the Tantric, the Chemical Brothers are back with their ninth album, No Geography, their first since Born in the Echoes 4 years ago, which feels like last week, and that's what time is like when you're old. Now a healthy 27 years into their career, Ed Simons and Tom Reynolds have pulled off something unique for that generation of electronic acts. Aphex might have the art school mystery, Orbital might be the chamber music of electronica, and until the appallingly sad death of Keith Flint, the Prodigy were definitely the AC/DC of rave. But the Chems are the grand son et lumiere happening of Acid House. What did we make of No Geography? Here's one of the singles. We've got to try.
Yes.
Geography. David Stubbs, you are the guru of electronic music. The Chemical Brothers have managed to keep making out their electronica and be stupendously commercially successful as well. Are you a fan? Are you a follower?
It's weird. I have a weird relationship with Chemical Brothers, personally. I always like them when I hear them. Anything they've done, you know, I'm never left cold by it. But at the same time, I've never felt that this is truly essential to the kind of, you know, pantheon. I think if they hadn't existed, as I've sometimes said, it wouldn't have been absolutely necessary to invent them. It's almost like that kind of thing. And yet, having said that, I really like that. I always thought about Echo and the Bunnymen in a funny kind of way, and the whole sort of thing. Similar sort of thing. I really enjoyed them, but I didn't feel that, like, if they'd gone missing, that history would have been that much different.
It's funny you say that, because whenever I hear them, I think, God, I wish I'd invented that hip hop plus acid house. Plus
Bits of salt. Oh no, I mean, it's a great sort of combination, whatever. Yeah, so I mean, you know, and once again with this album, I mean, I relate to a lot of it, because especially like some of the early tracks, like in the opening track, they sample Class Action by Weekend, which is a great favourite of mine from my Soul Boy days in 1982, and then there's a sort of Arthur Baker type feel, you know, in terms of the production. But what I do also appreciate is that they've brought this kind of sort of, as it were, this sort of fresh index of metals, you know, in terms of, like, you know, the sounds later on, you know, sort of a much more contemporary sort of feel and quite original touches, and the kind of weird little synth solo type thing on the kind of final track and what have you. So I do really appreciate all of that. I got the faint idea that this is an attempt to be kind of, you know, have some sort of contemporary relevance, whatever. And sometimes it's just, I suppose I find that like a little bit vague, you know, when they sort of like do that sample of "I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore." And I always think we've said that. Yeah, we all. Marc Francois probably feels like that as well. it's something that, you know, anybody could say from like very rhyme political positions.
To be fair, though, the title track and the cover artwork, which is a tank full of
I really
bad
like the cover
people,
artwork. Yeah,
facing off against a huge smiley face in the form of a cloud. Representing
that was
the
great.
Good people.
Exactly.
To me, that's a much more cleverly sophisticated version of the inner sleeve of the Prodigy's musical generation, where the good people are on one side of the cannon and the bad people are on the other. I don't think it's fully kind of politically abstract in that the title track is literally, you know, as close to an anti-Brexit Acid House record as you can get. It's like, everybody come here, come with me, bring everyone together, no geography. I've actually found that rather moving, you know, because it's not often that sort of electronic music grapples with that stuff. And kind of in tandem with it, you know, Matters Hell, Not Going to Take It Anymore, Free Yourself. These tunes kind of...
Those particular ones, I was thinking I was probably expecting a little bit more.
It's as kind of overt as it can get without sort of writing a full top-line lyric about, you know, let's have full Schengen and Euro Army now, which might be a little bit de trop for a house record. They do know their electronic deep cuts, don't they? I mean, there's also been a strong stream of Stockhausen, Can, all that kind of stuff to their music.
Yeah, and as I say, I mean, you know, there's an awful lot of stuff that feeds into it. I mean, I did like the album a great deal, despite, you know, what I actually, you know, those kind of caveats at the beginning.
Absolutely.
I noticed they also revive that kind of bass line, which the original Block Rockin' Beats type bass line gets in
a recall,
which is a bit unfortunate because that 23 Skidoo had originally used that on their single Coup, and it's more or less of a kind of a lift or a homage, let's say, but 23 Skidoo didn't really say much about it at the time. I think they were on the same label or something. But it's nice to get that kind of, you know, reference in, you know, to their past or whatever. So, yeah, it really covers the sort of the ages, really, I guess.
Yeah. Andy, did you enjoy it?
Quite. I sort of wanted for... Okay, really sweeping generalisation. For electronic music or dance music, I kind of want something that's got a massive groove that really I'm sucked in, you know.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it could be the bass drum pattern in the bass part, you know. Something that just, like, draws me in with a great groove. Really kind of funky. That's, to me, what it should be about. There were only a couple of points on this record that did that for me.
Free Yourself.
I think it could be that.
Yeah, which
it
is
it starts yourself. With a sort of... Starts with just melody and not much beat. And then this really cool beat comes in after, I don't know, 45 seconds or something.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is really good. I thought in general, it seemed to be quite retro. I don't know whether that's deliberate or not.
Retro is now, though, isn't it? The present is entirely composed
of
retro.
No, but I mean, when I use electronic stuff, I use it in a really modern, exciting, new way. And it's not sort of, that comes from that era or that comes from that. It's sort of now.
Yeah. Well, I think when you go and see
that's why I'm so unsuccessful.
When you go and see them, the mix of people is a huge spread of ages. It's like, it's not just kind of rave mom and dad and a big night for the babysitters of the rave diaspora.
Yeah.
You do get this 20-year-olds out, and for them, it's like... it's like them going. It's like other people going to see the Rolling Stones. Like, this is a legend, a thing that you
family.
Well, yeah, or, you know, it's like you've got to take it off your list. I've been to see the Kelman Brothers, and the one at Ali Pali at the end of last year was one of the most genuinely amazing things. Considering it's essentially two blokes standing behind, trestle tables pushing buttons as an experience, not just from the projections and the background stuff, but also the feeling in the room of an audience that really is on top of this stuff and really wants to pile into it was completely infectious, almost like a rave. They should try doing it in fields. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, it did all feel like, you know, it did feel like a sort of, you know, rave music. It did feel like proper house music. And that's why I say, like, from referring to an earlier time.
Yeah. I mean, Sean, I'm completely incapable of being objective about this because I love it and I love them. Completely on board. What did you think?
I think they're not an albums band in the way I've never listened to a Chemical Brothers album. I have gone and see them live. I used to go to Sunday Social every Sunday, sadly, where they residenced a long, long time ago, probably more than 27 years ago. And that's their that's where they live. They live for the live audience. That's where it has to be. And there is an element of live, and there's an element of it could go wrong. There's an element of we're going to mix this and it may not work. Blah, blah, blah. That's where I think it's really exciting. I have a problem, and I feel bad for saying that listening to a whole album sort of just doesn't do it for me. I need to be in that environment. And as much as I enjoyed it, and I think No Geography is an amazing track, I really, that was the one that really leapt out to me. My house wasn't the environment I needed to be in that point.
I think it does deliver quite well on that. They've always had a sort of strain of spangly, zoned-out cosmic ones, like Sunshine Underground or Radiate or Saturate in previous records. There's a couple of good ones here, like The Universe Sent Me and Catch Me, I'm Falling, where, you know, it's not necessarily you need to be, you know, off your nut at best of all. You can be, you know, in your own cosmic living room with the spangles surrounding it. I thought they were quite... there's a sort of separate side canon of Chemical Brothers cosmic ones.
Right.
The non-bangers. And I thought these are good additions.
Oh, I needed the non-bangers even to be in a different environment, I think. Mm. And you are right, they are harking back to some... They are self-referencing a lot. They're harking back to a lot of the old sounds, a lot of the first album, a lot of the acid house stuff that informed them has gone through. And I think for a band like them, it is really hard to say we've got to make new music, but we have to keep the old lot happy too. I think it's almost impossible to do that.
So I think that you did
it. Definitely runs the gamut. I mean, you mentioned, was it Free Yourself, isn't it? I mean, actually, that is a kind of one of the standout tracks to me as well. Yeah. It just sounds like it's got this kind of a collective Apache chant of like robots or something like that, doesn't it? Mm. Yes, that's a very eerie, interesting. Yeah.
But you saw them live recently, so it's still in your mind, you see. We all need to get out to the field and watch them.
Hey, Spring's here. Get out in the field. Get your raving trousers on. Sure.
Right. A little bit more music. Andy Gill, it's your turn to choose a track. What have you brought in for us?
It's Hot Pink by Let's Eat Grandma, a duo of young ladies who've done some really fantastic tracks. And this Hot Pink I love. It starts sort of quite nice and melodic, and then it goes into an enormous groove, really heavy, explosive sort of drums and stuff. And you don't know it's coming unless you've heard it before. It's keyboard based, and they stand there and they play keyboards.
Excellent. This is Let's Eat Grandma, Hot Pink. Let's hope we can fit enough of it in that you can get to that big explosive bit in the middle.
Oh, wait a minute.
Finally, what are the young people into these days? Terrifyingly youthful Los Angelino Billie Eilish has just pulled off the feat of becoming enormously successful without the vision of old people like me. The title of her album, When We Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go, might recall Philomena Cook's earnest inquiry, Where Does Your Lap Go When You Stand Up? But the joke's on you, Grandad, because her track When the Party's Over has been streamed a stupefying 324 million times on Spotify alone. That's a lot of 0.001 pennies. Is she any good? And is she appropriate listening for impressionable old people? Here's the opening track from her album. It's called Bad Guy.
Bruises on both my knees for you, don't say thank you, oh please. I do what I want when I'm wanting to. My soul, so cynical. So you're a tough guy, like you're really rough guy. Just can't get enough guy, just always so puff guy. I'm that bad type, make your mama sad type. Make your girlfriend mad type, might seduce your dad type. I'm the bad guy.
Got to say, that's a banger in anybody's language. The I Won't Tidy My Room Seven Nation Army for you there. Andy Gill, did Billie Eilish speak to you? Should it speak to people of the age of those of us in this room?
Well, everybody's telling us that it shouldn't, and that it's apparently for 14-year-olds. And I don't know who these 7 billion people are. Do we know? Mm-hmm. What age they are? Is it, you know, all teenagers? Is it young teenagers that are listening?
Well, I've got to say, I was in a high-end creative media agency yesterday, because that's the kind of metropolitan elite person I am, and they were battering Billie Eilish as well. So
were they?
Cutting through to media ponces, as well as the youth. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Well, there you go. So everybody's into it now. Mm. But, I mean, listening to it, it sounds quite mature. It doesn't sound like, I mean, I sort of thought, when I first started listening, I thought this is going to be like banging pop music and sort of very sneery, and it wasn't that. There was loads of ballads, yeah, fantastic singing, although albeit largely in the kind of whispery voice. And the production is clearly very good.
Yeah.
So it's a brother, isn't it? And yeah, he's
in a bedroom.
In a bedroom. And, yeah, you know, so lots of studios are going to go out of business.
Yeah, it's complete with Frank Sidebottom, Chris Seavey style bits of people saying, yeah, turn it up, this, we're doing the album now, get your finger out kind of thing.
I know, yeah, yeah.
Or whatever they say. So, yeah, yeah. I mean, the sound
is very sophisticated.
It
in
is
fact.
Very sophisticated. The sound's really sparse, isn't it? Very sparse, but loads of boom underneath it. Quite
subtle.
Yeah,
and great subtle strings. And, yeah, you know, all the parts are like really like accomplished and like very. Things that a very experienced producer would be getting.
Yeah, and she's, you know, it's very sort of, you know, undersung, breathy, kind of anti-singing. But she is brilliant with hooks and melody, and she's brilliant with kind of, you know, that one, Bad Guys, and it is an earworm on, like, two plays. And, you know, a track we played on the show before, Bury a Friend, it comes across to me like a super low-key, you know, teenage female Marilyn Manson, you know, gothic and nocturnal and fatalistic, but very kind of undemonstrative.
Right.
Before you say, you should say sneery, because all of her pictures are literally, oh, for God's sake, stop taking my picture.
Yeah.
They're all like
Kevin the teenager.
Oh, God.
Which is why you imagine the songs would be like, yeah, that, but they're not.
They're actually a lot funnier and clever, yeah, cleverer than that. A friend of mine got her autograph for his daughter. And instead of writing Love Billy, she wrote Le Billy, because she's too lazy to write a love. Mm. That's very much the attitude. Sean, you're an actual female. You used to be a teenage girl. When you were a teenage girl, would you have loved this?
No, I wouldn't have done, but I did love it now.
Okay.
I liked Jesus and Mary Chain when I was a teenage girl. I don't know if... And also, girls' music, boys' music. Let's just kick that out of the water.
Yeah.
I really like this. What I felt was, you're saying that it's very sparse. Some songs sound spiritual. Some songs, there's a jazz element to it, I thought. There's a Billie Holiday element to it. Suddenly, I could see all these layers, and there's a really interesting lineage between the people we used to have that did this were Avril Lavigne. They were, yeah, Katy Perry, that really highly ironic, marketed. This been done in a bedroom. This so much purer. And I've heard, what I've read about it is the kids like her because she's real. But actually, I like her because she's, yeah, real. This isn't put on. This isn't marketed. This is. She does snarl in her pictures. And I thought it was beautiful. I say it's really sophisticated, but the melodies are very... Dave Grohl has gone on about how he loves Billie Eilish. Similar to Nirvana and similar to The Police, they're nursery rhyme melodies.
Yeah.
So they're really, really hooky. They're really, really simple. They're sparse and they're confident. You think, oh, okay, I get it now. To me, a couple of listens now, just, oh, ping, it really, the light went on, yeah, in my head.
She's clearly listened to a lot. She and her brother have listened to a lot of weird, different music in their time, and they seem to be boho Los Angelino.
But musically adept,
parents.
They can make, yeah, it. You know, this isn't a bodge attempt. This isn't like our first album, we'll just sort of see how it does. This is, you know, finely tuned.
I really, 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 really hope it doesn't turn out the mom and dad wrote the songs. Because that would destroy me, because I love the idea that somebody can be this young and come out with such exciting, strange stuff. I mean, one hesitates to talk in terms of voices of a generation, which is getting a lot of that sort of talk, and there's a lot of lyrics about isolation and self-medication. There's a track called Zanny about Xanax,
and I don't know why that should just appeal to young people, because old people are quite,
well, it does appeal to old people. I am an old person. Yeah, and it appeals to me. David Stubbs, what do you think? You've got a teenage daughter.
I have got a teenage daughter, and it's interesting reading somewhere that Billie Eilish is really into people like Tyler, the Creator, you know, a lot of hip-hop, listens mostly to hip-hop, ASAP Rockin, because that's the sort of thing that my daughter, who's 14, listens to. So yeah. I really should be saying to her, look, Alicia, you know, come on. But she has actually said to me, Dad, I would rather wear your old underpants than take musical recommendations from them. It's not going to, you know, I've got to find these things for myself, so I've got to keep stummer. I've got to do some reverse psychology. It's like, daughter, never listen to this synthetic Billie Eilish nonsense. I want you to listen to Mumford & Sons. That's what I want, your father, and see if that works.
Yeah.
But no, I love this. And I expected to as well. You know, I'd seen the kind of people I've got similar tastes to that were really raving about this. I mean, it's got that kind of, you know, her voice is very, very sort of enervated. And that used to be really irritating.
Yeah,
that
kind of, girl with
a ukulele. It's a real horrible, yeah, sort of trope, and you see it in adverts and things like that. And that Taylor Swift version of The Earth, Wind & Fire, as it's September, he did a version of that, and it was all... But this is really well... You mentioned Billie Holiday, and I thought that as well. Mm. And Billie Holiday had that kind of small, enervated voice that was incredibly effective. I loved it. And I love the, you know, the fact that it's kind of sort of got this kind of non-sexual sort of seductiveness. It's more a kind of an atmosphere, a feel, a vibe. Also the weirdness of the involvement of her brother as well, that strange kind of sibling creation thing going on. And he is a little bit older, and I think he does feed in significantly into the kind of overall feel and sound, you know, the production of this. So really appreciate that. And I mean, you know, you can tell, you know, like tracks like Wish You Were Gay. I mean, you just look at the sort of title list and think, oh yeah, this is going to be interesting. Mm. But I just think generally, I mean, like, there's such, as much as in comedy, you know, like you've got this kind of feel that it's like Women in the Ascendancy or whatever, you know, your Fleabags and Derry Girls or what have you. I just feel we're almost like the kind of Arya Starkification of, like, you know, popular culture is definitely happening. I mean, and in pop, you know, part of the sort of female transgender continuum, you know, anybody from sort of, you know, Cardi B, you know, Robin, Sophie, people like that, and then through to the more avant-garde, you know, called Laurel Halo and Holly Herndon and people like that. You know, it's just where so much interesting music is coming from right now.
Yeah. One thing I did notice about this album is it's literally quiet. You literally can't... If you're a busy grown-up running around to your job, your crap job, you can't get what you need to get from this. You literally need to be in a bedroom, sealed off, in your own world, because it creates, like all the great records, it creates a world, and you can fall into it. Yeah. It's, and as Sean, you were saying, it's completely anti the kind of hyper-compressed pop. It's not trying to make you like it. It's not pandering to you.
It's sort of a wall, a barrage. I listened to it on headphones. Actually, weirdly, listened to it on headphones both times. Mm-hmm. And just because I thought I would anyway, so I was obviously gravitating towards that. It has to be intimate. Yeah. There's something about it.
Yeah. I feel I shouldn't like this because I'm like 30 years too old for it.
Doesn't matter.
But, you know.
Like what you like.
Actually, it's just an extremely likeable and exciting record, isn't it? Mm. And whistleable, which you don't get much of these days. So what you're saying...
Whistleable or whistleable?
Whistleable.
Oh, I hate whistling.
Do you? Mm. You don't actually have have whistling on the record. But you,
just hate it.
Yeah. I'm going to whistle I Love a Man in Uniform at you now and drag you screaming from the studio.
Well, not even Otis Redding on Dock of the Bay. I
mean, yeah.
No, especially.
Yeah. Come on, Roger Whittaker, come on. Yeah. So, David, basically, you're saying the input of the brother, is this basically the post-millennial Carpenters we're talking about here?
Yes.
All right, okay.
Yes.
Okay. Put that on the sticker on the front
in
of the
In a nutshell.
In a nutshell. Okay, well, the end of the show has arrived and snuck up on us. What will our guests be discussing over a can of Vimto with the amiable ghost of Frank Sidebottom? David Stubbs, what's your closing time chatter?
Right, yeah. It was just last Sunday, actually. I went to see a sort of Q&A with John Savage, who's just put together this oral history of Joy Division. It's sort of the searing light, the sun and everything else, I think it's called, which is something Tony Wilson said, apparently. And I hadn't actually dipped in properly to the book as yet, but it was a fascinating discussion. I mean, John Savage is a very sort of lucid, slightly kind of waspish character. At one point he was getting heckled by this other contemporary journalist there. This is up in Walthamstow, the Walthamstow Rock and Roll Book Club, I should make the point. And he did, do shut up, Michael. but he made some... There were two things. First of all, it was preceded by a lot of live footage of Joy Division that had been kind of ripped from YouTube. Here Are the Young Men, I think, was a film that somebody put together in 1982. And up on a big screen, and it was all kind of incredibly sort of hazy and misty or whatever. And, like, you know, you can see pixels and what have you. And you know, and it almost monochrome. You can just about make out kind of, you know, Ian Curtis doing his kind of butterfly dance and the cameras panning all over the shop. But what was interesting is that almost... It was almost like, you know, the way that a band sits in your kind of increasingly distant memory or whatever, you know, it was almost better for the footage to be like that, to be very, very hazy and misty and indistinct, you know, and conveying the sort of mists of time in a band that's kind of lives on in mythology now. But then the music itself, I'd really forgotten, actually, because I've always just listened to the Martin Hannett productions. What a completely different animal Joy Division were live. They were so raw and really so heavy and loud. It's almost like Butthole Surfers at times, something like that. That sort of heaviness, that kind of density. And then in the talk, John Savage made various interesting points. I mean, I always thought that in the late 70s, early 80s, reading NME and, you know, interviews with, like, your Gang of Four and people like that, and people like Au Pairs and Raincoats, that everybody was kind of woke. Everybody was dead feminist or whatever. Mm. But that wasn't really trickling through to the culture at Factory Records. It was a very, very sexist culture. And also homophobic, specifically. And John Savage mentioned that Tony Wilson was very uncomfortable with John Savage being gay. And apparently the reason for that is that Tony Wilson's own father was gay. And somewhat traumatically for young Tony Wilson, his boyfriend was called Tony. anyway, a jolly good afternoon and evening all round.
That book is great as well. Yeah. It's really, really enjoyable and illuminating and occasionally very funny as well.
Yeah.
Sean, what's your closing time chatter?
Well, Zamo from Grange Hill fame
yes.
is joining EastEnders. at last, I say.
Yeah, together again for the first time. Yes.
Yeah, he was painter and decorator or something. I've got that slightly wrong at the moment, and has an actual normal job, which I thought was rather wonderful, but is going to go into EastEnders and is going to play a milkman. Hmm. And is going to have some contretemps with Danny Dyer. And this is just a fact of what I love about the BBC is the BBC is so meta. In other words, you can never leave the BBC. They used not to allow you properly, and you couldn't advertise if you were on a show. You couldn't go to ITV and Channel 4. You know, you just couldn't. You were locked into this institution. And it's still trying to propagate that. And it's wonderful that he's just stuck, isn't he? Zamo is just stuck, and now he's going to be on a different soap. And I believe someone else is now on someone's in the Bill who died on EastEnders. I mean, you know, they just can't let go of the meta BBC.
I think what they need to do is they need to fully grasp it. And rather than creating a new character, it just needs to be Zamo's in EastEnders now. The beginning of the Grange Hill cinematic universe.
A much better idea. And then they could slowly introduce some more people. Roland as well would be very good.
Well, all of those characters in Grange Hill would now be sort of...
Yeah, and he would be
Zamo.
Probably
live in Essex or something like that, but they'd have relatives around.
Yeah,
around
and everyone could laugh about the heroin addiction. I remember when you were addicted to smack when you were at school. And also, I miss the...
Just say no, that's that record you put out.
I was going to say, I miss BBC Records. And so I really wish that we could get a new EastEnders tune out. Get that to the top of the streaming charts. I feel nostalgic for Just Say No and all. Something Out of Nothing, I think, was the EastEnders song. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
They all formed a band.
Did you notice David beatboxing in the background? They're beatboxing in the manner of Beardy Man. I think it's a very good idea. I think we need to be knitting these things together because, like the Marvel Universe, it all needs to fit.
Absolutely.
Call them Zamo. Andy Gill, what's your closing time chatter?
I was just thinking about the idea of sort of collectives and stuff. And whether bands still do that thing of collaborating with each other on things in general and practical things and working together and helping each other out and stuff. Gang of Four and Meekons famously did work closely together. We were all friends and we used to rehearse. We actually had some instruments, and when we put them down to go to the pub, the Meekons would step in and pick them up and rehearse with them. And then we got fed up with paying. We'd go somewhere to a pub or a club somewhere to play, and they charge us for using their poxy PA. So we said, let's make our own PA. And we actually, me and John King found a couple of old wardrobes, steamed the wood with a kettle so we could bend it and make bass horns. Andy Corrigan fiver each from all of us, and bought from a secondhand store some bass drivers that had been in RAF planes or something. And so we made it all. We bought a power amp between us. Again, like everybody put some money in. And Hugo had a transit van, and we put it in that, and we drive to venues and use it.
So basically, you invented the sharing economy that we hear so much about now. You invented Airbnb, basically.
Yeah, we did. And, you know, and you sort of think the sheer lack of realism in doing that, the drive that that we had to actually do that. I mean, actually putting manual labour, making these things and cajoling the lazy ones to actually put their effort in.
Well, that's what convinces you that you're actually a work unit where everybody has to do the tedious duties as well as the exciting ones of being on stage and singing.
That was my feeling, that we've all got to muck in and we do that. And then we went to the Buzzcocks were playing down the road. We said, let's go and play with them. We hadn't spoken to them at all.
Yeah.
We just turned up with our PA, spoke to Richard Boone, their manager, said, can we play before the Buzzcocks? Said, yeah, all right. We've got our MPA. Oh, you don't need that. You use ours. RPA that we'd...
Oh, that's lovely.
Like the ads it used to say in the papers years ago. Excellent band for events. Own PA.
Yeah.
Own PA and lecture. That pinging, by the way, that's messages going to Andy. People still want to hire that PA.
Yeah.
Because they're still coming through on WhatsApp.
Yeah. Yeah.
You still have
look. 15... All right, okay.
15 quid. Yeah. Yeah. Professional band, own light show, own PA. Yeah. Well, my closing time chapter is a very short one. I would exhort everybody to go and see Shazam, which is the best superhero film in years. It's really funny. It's got a lot of heart. It's really silly. It's in no way is it the tedious, grey, square-jawed, massively overwrought grimness of the Justice League and the other DC movies. But the best thing about it is essentially big in the form of a superhero movie. A kid, little kid, gets the magic word and becomes an all-powerful superhero. But the little wrinkle I want to pass on to you is it's not that the little kid becomes a superhero and then can act like an adult. It is that the little kid, when he becomes a superhero, gets to act like more of a kid than he's able to in real life. Because in real life, he's in a foster home. His life's grim, it's tedious, it's boring. And he becomes this kind of Superman analogue via some ludicrous hand-waving, you know, paranormal, supernatural superhero movie stuff. But as the all-powerful superhero, he acts like a big kid. And that's what's really heartwarming about it. And I would just say, if you are stuck with something to do this weekend, Shazam is a thing to do, but that's the thing to spot. And that is the end of the show. Thanks to our guest, Andy Gill. The Gang of Four have been touring the entire world. You've got one gig left in the UK at the Borderline. Is that right?
At this minute. Well, in Germany shortly after that.
Will you be festivaling the shit out of things this summer?
We're getting that. We just did Six Music last weekend. Been a bit of a buzz, so that was good.
Yeah.
Six Music Festival in Liverpool. Mm.
And Happy Now is out now.
It's out on the 19th.
Out on the 19th. I look at the title and I always think, it just makes me think of my dad going, Happy Now. You happy now?
Right.
You know. Yeah. Thanks for coming in. And you're going to stick around for the extra bit in a minute. David Stubbs, thanks for coming in. You got any more world touring coming on with the book?
I might be going to Spain. With the old double act with old man out of Harry Voltaire. Yeah, it's all got to be kind of fixed up. But then I think my globe trotting is probably over for this particular volume.
Well, thanks for coming in. Patreon backers, the extra bit will be with you soon, featuring more of the best and worst gigs we've attended. In the meantime, thank you, Sean.
Thank you.
You have to say it louder than that. Come on.
Thank you.
Thank you to producer Elsie Bath, and we'll see you all next week.